This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Janine Benyus. Janine is a natural science writer, innovation consultant, and author of 6 books, including Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. In Biomimicry, she names an emerging discipline that seeks sustainable solutions by emulating nature's designs and processes. Since the book's 1997 release, Janine has evolved the practice of biomimicry, consulting with sustainable business, academic, and government leaders, and conducting seminars about what we can learn from the genius that surrounds us. Janine has received several awards, including a Time International 2007 Hero of the Environment, the Rachel Carson Environmental Ethics Award, and the Lud Broman Award for Science Writing. Janine Benyus is here today to tell us about biomimicry and Nature's 100 Best Technologies, a project to identify the most promising of nature's technologies for humanity to emulate in its efforts to design a more sustainable, healthier planet. Welcome, Janine.
Thank you, Diane.
Would you begin by giving a definition of biomimicry?
Sure. Biomimicry is learning from and then emulating life's best ideas, nature's designs, chemical recipes, processes like photosynthesis, ecosystem strategies. It's a design discipline that's being practiced by engineers and architects and product designers, the people who make our world. And when they go to solve a problem, they ask themselves, what in the natural world is trying to solve the same problem I have? And how might I use that design or recipe or strategy as a model?
What led you to the concept of biomimicry?
Well, I'm a natural history writer. That's what I did for years. I had written 5 books, and they were all about plant and animal adaptations. You know, how a beaver is able to spend long periods of time underwater, or how swifts are able to fly so quickly. And I looked at these adaptations in the natural world. They were elegant, and you know, usually they used a minimum of materials, you know, a minimum of energy. They were non-toxic. And I thought, these technologies, who's trying to imitate them? You know, is anyone actually trying to learn, not just about nature, but is anybody trying to learn from nature? And then I started, I think the first article I saw was in a really obscure journal, and it was about people studying photosynthesis, studying leaves, to figure out a way to make better solar cells. And I thought, oh my gosh, here it is. But there wasn't really an umbrella term. There wasn't a name for it. So I started collecting articles, and then I had to name a folder, and that's when I wrote biomimicry on the folder.
Would you elaborate on how the approach to problem solving is different using biomimicry?
Well, you know, very often designers, say a designer who's making a new way to desalinate water, what they'll do is they'll look at other engineering solutions. You know, they might look at other countries and how they've solved it. They might go through the human patent database. In this way of innovating, they actually invite a biologist to the design table. And we have a company called Biomimicry Guild, which is 12 biologists, and they'll bring us in, and we'll actually sit with them, and they'll say, well, how does nature take salt out of water? And so we'll describe to them how mangrove roots work, or how your own kidney works, or the nasal gland of seabirds. And we'll describe, you know, what's in the biological literature about all of these amazing filters. And that will inspire the engineer to do a completely new kind of membrane they had never thought of.
Are there certain types of problems for which biomimicry is particularly useful?
Yeah, I think, you know, anywhere where you want to sip energy, if you want to save energy, life really knows how to do that. Or if you want to minimize the amount of materials that you use, if you want to make something really strong but lightweight, organisms are fabulous at doing that. You know, think of skulls of birds and how lightweight birds have to be. Also, controls, like the ability, for instance, to morph your wings and to really ride and surf air, anything to do with transportation, you know, flowing through water or air, organisms are great at it, and sensing. They're also really amazing at doing chemistries that occur in body temperature and in water. I mean, you know, you think about the amazing materials in the world like spider silk, which is 5 times stronger per weight than steel, or the mother of pearl inside of abalone shells. I mean, that's twice as tough as any ceramic that we make, but of course it's not made in a kiln or an oven. That's another area, the whole field of materials. And of course, energy harvesting. Life is tremendous at both harvesting energy, saving energy. The one I really like these days is to look at the natural world to see how organisms gather water. You know, we tend to get our water from streams or from lakes or from aquifers. And there's a whole suite of species that get their water out of air, which we really don't. You know, out of humid air and out of fog. And I think one of the most promising technologies is, you know, people who are looking at desert insects, seeing how on their wing scales they actually accumulate fog in the morning. They have a special patterned structure that grabs the water out of fog and then quickly directs it down to the organism's mouth. It's very simple, but creating sheets of this could allow us to, for instance, wrap a building in a skin, a sheet that would grab fog. You can think in San Francisco on the hillsides of San Francisco, grabbing fog in the morning that then, you know, feeds the building during the day.
Would you tell us now about the Nature's 100 Best Technologies project? How did this come about?
Sure. We realized that there were dozens of case studies that were popping up. Companies were being formed around ideas, but that there were a lot of ideas in the natural world that have not yet been mimicked, but should be. And we thought, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if we could filter feed through the biological literature with, in one hand, having a list of sustainability challenges in the world, and in the other hand, have natural history literature, and try to actually identify some ideas that have not yet been mimicked. And so we did, and we spent about a year, and we came up with over 2,100 ideas. And 100 of them we chose to put into a book project. But the other 2,000 we're putting up on the web in a website called asknature.org. We've organized them by function. So if they have to do with adhesion, whether it's beetles or barnacles or muscle glue, if you're looking for another non-toxic adhesive, you can type in adhesive and up will come all of these ideas.
How did you go about selecting and evaluating the different candidates for Nature's Best? What criteria did you use?
Well, we got in front of us the millennial goals, tried to look at things that were worthy challenges, things that the world really needed, things about the food system, water, health without antibacterial resistance, industrial processes without toxic chemicals. We would look at very particular technical challenges, like in a fuel cell. One of the things that makes it so expensive is platinum, which is a catalyst. It's a heavy metal. It's really expensive. And we knew that there were organisms that did the same kind of hydrogen chemistry, but of course without platinum. So we would try to match worthy challenges with elegant solutions in the natural world.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Jeanne Benyus, co-founder of the Biomimicry Institute and Biomimicry Guild, and author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, as well as the upcoming book, Nature's 100 Best. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give a few examples of Nature's 100 Best, the ones that have been chosen?
Sure, I'd love to. You know, I mentioned health, and there's a real need to preserve vaccines in order for them to get from the lab to the village. And 50% of them don't make it. And the reason is that they need to be refrigerated right now. So there's a break in the cold chain. And then there's all kinds of issues we have with preservatives. So the question is, how does nature preserve things? And one of the masters of preservation is a plant called a resurrection plant, and it uses a sugar in its cells that actually, as it dries out, it actually, the trehalose replaces the sugars, and it really protects the cells. So there's actually a commercial product from this. It's a vaccine storage device by a company called Cambridge Biostability. But the question is, can we also use the same sort of thing as an alternative to chemical preservatives? Another couple of examples, there's glass is made in the ocean by diatoms, small microscopic organisms called diatoms, and sea sponges. They make things out of silicon. Of course, we have very toxic ways of making, say, computer chips. There are scientists at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who have figured out how to mimic the way a diatom makes glass underwater in completely non-toxic ways. Another area that's really interesting is the creation of color without toxic pigments. When you see a peacock or a brilliant butterfly in the tropics, you are not seeing chemical pigments. Instead, you're seeing a layered structure. It could be transparent, but the way the material, very simple material, is layered, it's structured, it plays with light in such a way to create color to your eye. This could open up a whole new realm of paintless color for walls, say. In other words, you could just have thin film on a wall that played with light in such a way to create color instead of paint, avoiding all those toxins, and it's actually 4 times brighter than paint. In the physics realm, there's all kinds of great examples. There's a humpback whale on its flipper. If you'll notice, it has these sort of scalloped edges on the leading edge of its flipper. And the reason for that is that it's able to really be graceful in the water and to make very tight turns in order to find krill and when it does bubble feeding. And a scientist named Frank Fish, believe it or not, studied this phenomenon and said, wouldn't this be a good idea for wind turbine blades? Because one of the problems they have is with stalling in very slow speeds. And the humpback whale can actually achieve a 40% greater angle without stalling. So sure enough, putting the same pattern, the same blueprint on a blade enables their blades, it's a company called Whale Power, to rotate at very slow speeds, which is important for making sure that, you know, we can do wind power in all kinds of conditions.
Do there seem to be common features among the solutions that nature provides?
Yeah, the thing that nature's technologies show us over and over and over again is that they use shape instead of more material. So, you know, a porcupine's quill, for instance, is a really strong cylinder, and people are actually trying to mimic that for beams for buildings. But it's a shape that nature uses instead of bulking it up with more material. That's one of the things. Another thing is that very few materials, very few elements in the periodic table are used. You know, we use all the elements in the periodic table in chemistry, and we do it with brute force. You know, we heat it and beat it and treat it and brute sort of recipes, and every element, even if it's toxic. But in the natural world, it's quite the opposite, the rest of the natural world, I should say. Very few elements are used, life-friendly elements, but they're put together with elegant recipes. So that's this whole world of trying to figure out nature's recipe book and mimic that. Another thing is that none of these things work in isolation. They work as part of a system. So the technologies in the natural world, they're created out of local materials. And at the end of their lives, they dissolve back into that habitat. Now, what that means is that they, by definition, cannot be toxic in a long-term way, because the same organisms that, you know, the organisms that are living in a place, a tree, for instance, putting on leaves, those leaves will fall beneath the tree. So any seedlings, their offspring, if they want to protect their offspring, they have to protect the place that their offspring will live in generations from now. So what's happened is through long periods of evolution, foolish technologies have been edited out over time. And those that are best for life get carried on into the next generation. I think that's the biggest lesson, the biggest commonality, is that no matter what technology we're talking about, life creates conditions conducive to life. And that's the thing that we're trying to learn in our technologies, to take up less room on this planet, to actually learn how to enhance the place by building soils rather than depleting them, and cleaning air rather than polluting it. And these technologies manage to do that.
What steps should be taken if someone wants to use a problem-solving approach based on biomimicry?
Well, you know, I think the first step is quieting human cleverness. We do a lot of workshops with designers, engineers. We'll take them to Costa Rica, architects, and we'll bring them into places that are, you know, just literally teeming with solutions. And they bring design challenges from work, actual design challenges. But these are companies like Boeing and General Electric and Herman Miller and General Mills, and, you know, large companies. These are the problem solvers. They come with a design challenge. First thing they have to do is forget what they've known. Quiet human cleverness, and literally then open their eyes and open their ears and listen. That's the next step. So look into the natural world. They come with a design challenge, and they figure out what function they actually want to perform. You know, say they want to learn how to reduce friction. Then they go in to the natural world with a biologist and say, what are all the examples of friction-reducing technologies that I can see? They put those before them, and then they try to emulate those. So the third step is emulating it. And the fourth step, that's when they come up with phenomenal innovations. And then what we do is we ask them to look at a list of life's principles, sort of general guidelines for how life works. And so when they then go to try to create that product, they start to ask themselves, where would I get the energy for this product? And of course, that would be from the sun. And how would I do the chemistry to make this product? And of course, that would be chemistry in water at low temperatures. You know, so we look through a list of life's principles with them. So it's more than just the blueprint, but rather the guidelines that we also take from the natural world. And then finally, we really encourage people to say thanks to the organism that inspired them. At the Institute, we have a program called Innovation for Conservation, in which we ask companies to donate a percentage of their proceeds to conserve the habitat of the organism that gave them such a good idea. So really at that, you know, that last step is the Thanksgiving loop.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Janine Benyus, co-founder of the Biomimicry Institute and Biomimicry Guild, and author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, as well as the upcoming book, Nature's 100 Best. What are some ways that biomimicry could be used to address climate change?
You know, the first step is really, how are we going to gather sunlight rather than burning fossil fuels? Because the number one energy gathering system on this planet is photosynthesis. And so there's actually commercialized thin film solar cells available right now from a company called Kanarka, another company called Daisol in Australia. And these thin film solar cells are based on photosynthesis. They're made with very non-toxic materials, titanium dioxide, and a dye. Chlorophyll's a dye. That's what's in leaves. And using a dye to pull down the sun and then using another material to separate the charge, that's what leaves do. And these thin film solar cells are about a fifth of the cost of normal solar cells. So that's one thing. There's a wave energy harvesting device that's a company called BioPower makes, that is based on the movements of sea kelp and how they move back and forth. And they've mimicked that and created an energy harvester out of that. There's a wind turbine based on the humpback whale's flippers. The other thing besides gathering energy is using it wisely. There's a building in Zimbabwe that is called Eastgate. And it has no air conditioning in the middle of Zimbabwe. It's huge. It's about 9 stories high and about a city block wide. what it does is the architect, Mick Pierce, mimicked the channels and the ventilation strategies of the termite mound. And it uses about 10% of the energy in a conventional building. And since then, many buildings with natural ventilation based on the termite mound have come about. There's also a company right in California in San Rafael called PAC Scientific. And they've mimicked a very ubiquitous shape in the natural world. It's a flow form, a spiral flow form that you find in seashells, and you even find it in your own skin pore. Anywhere flow needs to go, water needs to go, or air needs to flow without friction, is this shape. We see this shape. And they've put that shape into water mixers that can mix water with the energy of a light bulb, mix a million-gallon tank that you see in a municipal city supply. There's fan blades that save 30 to 50% of energy, all just based on this ubiquitous shape in the natural world. So there's harvesting energy, there's saving energy. I think with climate change, we really have to look at removing the excess CO2 that we have. And organisms are really instructive there as well, because in the natural world, CO2 is not a poison the way we see it. We exhale CO2, but plants take it in. I mean, plants use CO2 as a raw material. That's where they get their carbon for sugars and starches and cellulose. And so there's a company called Novomer that's actually created a catalyst that is able to take CO2 and waste from citrus operations, limonene, and make a biodegradable plastic out of CO2. Unilever has just invested in them. So you might be seeing packaging, for instance, biodegradable packaging made from CO2. So suddenly when you start to think that way, the CO2 coming out of smokestacks becomes valuable. Doesn't become something you're racing to get rid of, but rather something you're incorporating into another product. There's a company called Solera in California that is using a coral reef recipe to take CO2 and make it into cement. Cement's 8%, concrete's 8% of our CO2 emissions worldwide. And usually a ton of cement will release a ton of CO2 into the air. And Solera is taking CO2, making the raw material for concrete, and they're cutting that CO2 emission by half.
How is our culture likely to be different if biomimicry is widely used?
That's a great question, Diane, because I think that culturally, what biomimicry has to offer is far more important in many ways than just the technological innovations. Because what happens in the process of looking to the natural world for inspiration and trying to emulate what you see, what happens is this really increased respect for this organism. That's what I see in the scientists and inventors trying to emulate how a spider makes a web. My goodness, they're the ones who... they have absolute respect for this organism because they've tried to mimic it and it's tough to do. That cultural change, you know, if more and more people began to regard organisms and ecosystems as teachers rather than warehouses, you know, as sources, as mentors of how to live sanely and sustainably on Earth, that one cultural shift from being a conqueror to being a student and to having respect, you know, rather than hunting in the natural world for what we can extract and what we can grind up and what we can make into something. Instead, going to the natural world and saying, what can you teach me? That's a very different cultural spirit. And in changing our stance towards the natural world, my fondest hope is that we would be inspired to try to preserve and conserve the genius that surrounds us.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, if I could tell people listening to this radio broadcast something, I would say, please get up, go to a door, turn a doorknob, and go outside. And look at the natural world again for the first time. Do as the French say, regard. Regard the natural world in a new way. And whatever design challenge you have, whether it's the design of a new house or trying to figure out how to design a life, there are many models and patterns in the natural world, you know, that are freely available to you. It's a matter of just quieting human cleverness and listening. So go outside.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Janine.
Okay, thanks, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Janine Benyus, co-founder of the Biomimicry Institute and Biomimicry Guild, and author of Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, as well as the upcoming book, Nature's 100 Best. For more information, check on the web at www.biomimicryinstitute.org and www.biomimicryguild.com. Again, biomimicryinstitute.org and biomimicryguild.com. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.